Hey there, Right Bites Club, and welcome to this month's interview.
It's awesome to have someone with close to almost 30 years writing experience now. That's pretty
35 years this year.
35, okay. Yep. The PDF, I guess, was about 6 years behind on that one. That's awesome. Basically what I wanted to do, I have a few specific questions I'd like to ask about kind of your career and what you've done over the years, and then we'll take some Q&A towards the back half. But to start, can you kind of just give us like a Cliff Notes version of kind of what your career has looked like from, you know, when you first got into the writing field till today?
Sure, glad to. Again, 35 years I get to by going back to 1985 when I graduated college with a journalism degree and went to work for a newsletter publishing company. Again, this is 1985, well before the internet. Everything that was written appeared in print. And so this company specialized in producing newsletters that were sent mainly from banks, financial institutions, and healthcare organizations out to their customers, mostly as statement stuffers. So we used to joke that what we produced was birdcage lining. It's the statement it's the newsletter that's in your bank statement that you just throw out and in the trash right away. But, you know, the banks paid good money for those, and it was a great, great training ground for learning how to become a professional writer. So I spent 12 years at that company in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, from 1985 to 97. Moved to Atlanta in 97 to work for another company essentially doing the same thing. Okay. In fact, they were a competitor, a much smaller competitor of the first company that I worked for. Worked for them from 1997 until 2005 when they were acquired by a much bigger company. Again, all in the same industry. This industry was known as custom publishing back in the days. Okay. Nowadays, it's content, custom content, content creation. You know, the buzzwords change, but back then it was called the custom publishing industry. Okay. Worked for that company from 2005 until 2009, and specializing in the financial services division of the company. And then, of course, we all know what happened in late 2008 when the financial crisis hit. I knew at that point that it wasn't a matter of if, but when they were going to have to let me go because the business was just drying up. And so sure enough, I was laid off the first week of January in 2009. And at that point, I had a decision to make, either go look for another job. The prospects were pretty much slim to none at that time, or go ahead and, you know, hang a shingle out and see if I can make a go of it as a freelancer. And, I had several things that were really working for me at that point that convinced me that, you know, trying freelance was the way to go. First of all, I had started doing freelance work on the side when we first moved to Atlanta in 1997. Okay. And so that was, I mean, I can't stress how huge that was. I had a handful of clients. I knew how the freelancing game worked. I knew how to price work. I knew how to deliver, you know, work that clients were looking for. And so basically I had already gotten my feet wet in freelancing just by doing, you know, the side hustle. The other main thing that I had working in my favor was a niche, a great niche, the financial services niche, and 24 years of experience in that niche. So I really knew it inside out. I knew the financial services industry from a communications and marketing perspective inside out. Yeah. I had a lot of contacts in the industry. And so all of those things combined, it was pretty much a no-brainer that I would go ahead and see if I could make a go of it as a freelancer. So that's what I did first week of January 2009, so about 11 and a half years ago. I tell people 3 months into it, I had a pretty good feeling that it was going to work out. 6 months into it, I knew it was going to work out, and by the end of my first full year of freelancing, I had almost matched my full-time income as a full-time employee the year before. Awesome. By the end of my second year, I had exceeded that income level and haven't looked back since.
Totally. That's awesome. And so when you made that initial transition to freelance, What was your strategy going into it to take advantage of those contacts you had developed and generate your own business? Because obviously that was probably the only real difference between what you were doing before, at least at first, and as a freelancer, was that you are now generating your own business instead of fulfilling business that someone else has generated. What was your strategy going into that? And through your first year, did that kind of evolve at all? Did it work pretty much exactly like you were expecting, or did you kind of get into it and start adjusting as you went? What did that kind of first year of lead generation look like?
Great question. It was really a matter of taking the small book of business that I had, my side business, and building that up. Like I said, I had a lot of contacts in the industry. So I just started reaching out to people that I knew over the years, people that I had worked with at my former employers, letting them know what happened. One of my favorite stories is I had two of my freelance clients, my own freelance clients. I got my layoff call on a Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock. I mean, textbook, by the book. And literally as soon as I hung up the phone, I fired off emails to two of my existing freelance clients saying, "Hey, I just got laid off from my job. I can take as much work as you can send me." Both of them replied before the end of the day and said, "I'll have something for you on Monday." Awesome. And so literally my first day of self-employment, I had paying work, and I have pretty much every day since.
<Love it.
laughs> That was another great sign. That was another sign that I think this is going to work out. But as far as, overall strategy, I mean, I'd be lying if I told you I had this grand plan and strategic plan and everything. Honestly, I really didn't. It was just a matter of, I know how to do this. I've got a tremendous niche. I've got great experience. I've got a lot of contacts. Now I'm just going to start beating the bushes and seeing what I can get. And another thing I like to tell people is when you take that 40 to 50 hours, whatever is a week that you're devoting to an employer, and devote it to yourself, to your own business, it's amazing. It's amazing what you can do. It's amazing. Literally, when I had, all day, every day to work on my own business instead of somebody else's business, things just started happening. I also tell people it's kind of like a stone rolling down a mountain. It just starts gathering momentum. You pick up a new client here, you pick up a new client there. They tell somebody else about you, they contact you, you pick that client up, and once that ball starts rolling and gathering momentum, it just keeps going. And but all of that is just to say that I didn't have a grand plan, but I just kind of dug in. I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do. I had a pretty good idea of how to make it happen. And I just started, working all day, every day on my own business instead of somebody else's business. And before I knew it, it was working pretty well.
Totally. That's awesome. And one point I want to clarify there, you talked about devoting full-time hours to your own business, but you obviously didn't have a full-time schedule of actual writing to do once you started. I kind of get the feel from the way you're describing this, that for you, it was just a given that you're going to spend those extra hours of the week that aren't going to your writing, going out and reaching out, pitching people, sending out, stuff to try to generate business immediately. And that's just kind of what you did. Whereas to kind of juxtapose that with, people who are just getting into the space nowadays, and particularly in my generation, I feel like the whole beat the bush pitch isn't necessarily the given people think of when how you go generate leads. It's kind of like we have all these inbound channels nowadays that people think is going to create immediate lead flow for them. So I just kind of wanted to clarify there, like when you got some work on Monday, let's say that took you, 10 out of your 40 hours of the week to do, what did you spend, kind of what were you spending that other 30 hours on? Was it all outreach or was there anything else in particular that you spent that extra time towards? Was it getting your website up or building your brand? Kind of what did those other hours look like?
My situation was pretty unique. And one thing that I didn't mention, but I should mention it in response to your question, is that my former employer did give me contract work for about a year.
Awesome.
So I had probably 10 to 20 hours a week of contract work from my former employer during that first year. So that's huge. Again, that is everybody, huge. Totally. Everybody doesn't have that. So between that and the work that I was able to drum up pretty quickly, I honestly was able to spend most of my work time every week, even during that first year, doing actual real writing work.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's killer.
I hesitate to say that because it's a very unique situation. Most people don't just stumble into something like that like I did.
Totally.
And I wish I had some great advice to give you in terms of how to, you know, build up a business from scratch and all the, you know, things that I did. I'm not going to bluff my way through that because I really don't.
I love it.
I just kind of fell into a perfect situation for starting a freelance business is kind of what happened.
That's killer. So in that case then, and I think, you know, that's somewhat relevant, probably more relevant to the current audience we have here at Right Minds, because most people have some level of client base, some level of recurring work, which leads us right into the next phase for you, because at some point you started to target SEO, and you started to create your own content to build that inbound leads channel, particularly around the financial services side of things. At what point in your freelance journey did you kind of get wind of wanting to do that? And what did the process look like? Kind of how long did it take you to start bringing in some inbound leads beyond just the normal referral leads that you were generating?
Great. So again, we're going back to 2009. Obviously the internet had been around for, you know, a decade plus at that point, but it still wasn't a given that every self-employed professional was going to have a website. Most did, but it wasn't unusual to find one who did. But I mean, I'd been doing what I do long enough that I knew that obviously that was the first step. So I had a friend who built websites, and he actually built one for me for free.
Nice.
I mean, you kind of get what you pay for. It was okay, and it actually served its purpose for the first year or two. And it was probably a year or two into it when I realized that I needed to ramp that up significantly. And so at that point, I actually hired somebody to build one for me. But I realized that, and I knew enough about SEO to know how important that was as well. And so given the fact that I did some SEO copywriting for my own clients, I figured, well, I'm going to write the copy myself. I mean, I pretty much know how to do that. So I had someone build and design the site for me, but I wrote the SEO copy myself. Now, I don't position myself as an SEO copywriting expert because I'm not, but I know enough about it to do it at a basic level, let's say.
Totally.
And essentially, that's what I needed. And so the first step, of course, with SEO is come up with the right keywords. And so I just did some brainstorming with myself, basically. It was like, if somebody is looking for me, if somebody's looking for my services, what are they going to Google? And so I just messed around. I did some brainstorming. I did a little keyword research and came up with what I thought were two very good keyword search phrases for me. Freelance financial writer and freelance business writer. Those are basically what I do, freelance financial writing and freelance business writing. So those are my two keyword search phrases. So I wrote all the copy optimizing those phrases. And hey, buddy.
Feel free to continue. I'm going to get him situated.
No problem. So I wrote all the copy optimizing those phrases. And within the first couple of weeks of the website going live, I was ranking on the first page for those keyword phrases. And it didn't take too much longer after that. Then I was up in the first few results, and I have been ever since.
Okay, awesome.
All right. Did you get that?
Yeah, got double duty here. okay, awesome. So that's, you know, we talk a good deal about SEO stuff here, but I wanted to get kind of your personal experience, because you're you're one, you know, I tell people all the time to try to rank for their niche copywriting related term, but very few people actually do it. And you have, and it's, you know, generated some good business for you over the years.
That is so important. And this gets into the niche versus generalist thing, which we can talk about if you want. I'm a big believer in niche freelancing. Now, again, because of my background that we've talked about, it worked out pretty good for me. I've got a super niche. There's high demand, it's high paying, and there's a very, very small universe of freelance writers out there who specialize in what I specialize in. Now, again, I'm not saying I'm the only one, but it's a really small pond. Small pond.
And I'm curious, I'd love to learn a bit more about your niche, the kind of the business financial newsletter niche. And I'm curious if there's aspects of it where there's demand that can be filled by someone who doesn't have 24 years in the space, maybe for people who might be interested in getting into that niche, or just the newsletter niche in general, because it is, it's become a somewhat smaller, but not, it's still not a small, you know, niche. There's still a lot of businesses that still send out newsletters. And so I'd love to hear more about that, and kind of even a little similar to what you talked about in the piece on newsletters that, you know, that we did here recently. Would love to hear kind of a bit more about that and the demand and opportunity there.
Sure. So again, newsletters are what I grew up on. I started work for a newsletter publishing company right out of college. I basically learned the newsletter format. Now, obviously, newsletters went through a drastic shift from print to electronic in the late 1990s and on into the 2000s. Nowadays, you know, when you say newsletter nowadays, people think e-newsletter, electronic newsletter. People don't usually think print newsletter anymore. Although print newsletters still exist, I have several clients who I still write print newsletters for.
Okay.
They're accounting related, and they're subscription-based. They're publishing companies, and they produce subscription-based newsletters. We call them canned, quote-unquote, canned newsletters that accounting firms can purchase from the publishing company, stamp their name on them for a personalization, and send it out to their customers and prospects.
Okay.
So that's one really good avenue for freelancers who are looking to get into newsletter writing, is to approach these publishing companies, and that's what they do.
Yeah.
Especially on the financial services side. Again, the ones that I write to are accounting related, also some business finance related. So that's a big opportunity. E-newsletters, of course, are huge. I mean, I've published my own e-newsletter. I started publishing my own e-newsletter in probably 2012 or so, 2 or 3 years after starting full-time freelance. I try to send it out once a month. Of course, I write it myself. Even designed it myself, not a tech guy or a design guy, but, you know, Constant Contact makes it pretty much idiot proof. And so, again, sending out an e-newsletter is a no-brainer, for your own personal brand, as well as for clients. I mean, you know, there's so many professional service providers, lawyers, accountants, you name it, really, solo entrepreneurs, who want to send out an e-newsletter, but, you know, they don't know how to write. They're not good writers. They don't like writing. They just as soon hand that off to somebody else. That's another huge opportunity for freelancers, is to find self-employed, solo entrepreneurs, small business owners who need help with their e-newsletter.
I think almost every business on the planet wants to be doing more to help with customer retention. And it just always ends up being like a back burner thing almost in a lot of industries, especially where people are putting budget towards like client acquisition and they're doing some baseline things for retention. But newsletters can be such a powerful thing for existing customer retention, and almost everyone would like to be doing more. You know, so that's super interesting. Awesome. So that was pretty much, those are the main questions I personally wanted to ask. So I thought we could go ahead and open up the floor here to any of our attendees here who would like to ask a question. If you have something specific, and someone else is already, like, we're in discussion as usual, just throw it in the chat and we'll head over to that one next. But Right off the bat, did anyone want to jump in and ask a question?
Yeah, it's Jen.
Hey, Jen.
I don't know if you can see me right now.
We can.
I noticed your sample. I've just been checking out your website, and I noticed the sample section, which I love, the different website, copy, magazine, newsletters. I was just wondering how that performs for you, because it just looks like such a good section of your website.
Oh, thank you. I just had my website redesigned like a month ago. It looks so much better now than it did a month ago, and I'm so glad I did it before we did this interview. how well is it performing for me? I mean, I couldn't really answer the question based on specific feedback that I've gotten, but I did put a lot of thought into designing it the way that I did and organizing it the way that I did. Before I just had, the samples were just on there kind of willy-nilly. There wasn't a lot of good organization or thought put into it. And so when I did some redesign, I didn't completely redesign my site, but I went in and did a decent amount of, you know, tweaking and changes to it. And the sample page was one of the main things that I focused on, because it was very poorly done before. And I'm so glad to hear you say that it looks so much better now. Thanks.
Oh, good.
It really does look super cool.
Yeah, I would love to come up with a page like, you know, do something like that. I need a lot more samples, though. It's great.
Well, I've had a lot of years to come up with a lot of samples.
Oh, my goodness. And can I also ask, I'm sorry, I missed the first part coming into the session, but where were you working before? What kind of financial service companies?
Sure, of course. They were newsletter publishing companies. Back in the day, they were called custom publishing companies. The first one was a company called First Marketing Company in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. They don't exist anymore. But the second one was a company called Media 3 Publications here in Atlanta, Georgia. And they were acquired by McMurray. It used to be called McMurray Publications. They changed their name a couple of times. And they've since been acquired a couple of times also. But so none of those companies actually exist anymore. they were all three, again, newsletter custom publishing companies that specialized in custom communications. And they had different divisions that serviced different industries: healthcare, hospitality, travel and entertainment, financial services. I always concentrated in the financial services niche because, again, that's what I knew. And to be honest, it's what I enjoyed too. If you had asked me in 1985 when I graduated college, what was my career goal, writing financial and business articles would not have been high on the list. In fact, I wanted to be a sports writer, but that never worked out. But I ended up falling into a pretty good niche that's enabled me to have a good career and make a decent living too.
Cool. Hey, just one thing. Have you had any problem then with conflict of interest between clients?
Good question. No, I haven't. A couple of clients over the years have asked me about it. And I mean, to be honest, it's never really been an issue. Especially when you specialize in a niche, the clients know that they're not going to get you exclusively. They know that, you know, when I hire Don Sadler to write my financial content, he's not going to write financial content for anybody else. I mean, that's just not realistic. They know that what they're paying for is your industry expertise, which you have because you work with lots of financial clients over the years and you continue to work with financial clients. So it's never really been an issue. It's a good question, but it's never really come up as an issue.
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Don. By the way, the photo in the background, where are you skiing?
Grand Targhee.
Nice. Thanks for that.
I have a quick question. When we talk about a typical like newsletter gig, I was wondering if you would be open to sharing like what it entails, just kind of like an average gig, what it entails, if it's recurring, and what the deliverables look like. and kind of what the average rate you might make for like a single gig like that would look like if you're open to sharing that.
Sure, of course, of course. So a typical newsletter gig for me is a 4-page print newsletter, actually 4, 6, maybe 8-page print newsletter, for which I'm hired to research and write the articles. Okay. I'm not involved, actually, in some content planning as well. I'm usually responsible for either coming up with the content topics and ideas or working with a committee that the client has established that are all subject matter experts. For example, accounting is my main niche when it comes to these newsletters that we're talking about.
Okay.
And so my client has formed an advisory board of other accountants who obviously know what's going on in the world of accounting. And we get together virtually on a regular basis and talk about topic ideas that are relevant. I bring some ideas to the table because, again, I know the industry somewhat, not like these guys who do it all day, every day. But, you know, I know enough to bring some topic ideas to the table. Obviously, they have topic ideas. And so we work together in coming up with the editorial calendar. So that's step number one. And then of course, I'm hired to write the actual articles. I don't do any, you know, newsletter design, layout, production, anything like that. I'm strictly the writer. So I draft the articles based on my own research as well as primary interviews with some of these subject matter experts, either on the committees or sometimes they'll recommend people that I speak with. So I do a decent amount of primary research, calling and doing telephone interviews. I draft the articles, send them off to the client, and I also handle as many rounds of revisions as are necessary until the copy is finally approved. Sometimes that goes like clockwork and requires literally no revisions whatsoever. Sometimes, especially with more technical and complex topics, I can go through 2 or 3 rounds of revisions. Even those aren't really that extensive. And that's the extent, that's my responsibility with my newsletter clients. Just to give you an idea of pay, I bill $2,000 for a 4-page newsletter that consists of about between 1,500, about 2,000 words, about 2,000 words, so about $1 a word. And as far as ongoing and recurring, yes, that's one of the beauties of newsletters. They go every quarter or every other month, like clockwork. And unless it stops for some reason, and they do, newsletters don't always go on forever. Although I have to tell you that one newsletter that I worked on for one of these clients that I'm talking about, I started working on that newsletter at my first job in Fort Lauderdale in 1989. And then through a series of events, I ended up getting it as a freelance client. Actually ended up getting them at one of my next employers. We ended up basically stealing the business, my former employer. And then when I went full-time freelance, I basically stole it from my former employer. Because I don't know if I should have admitted that or not, but I had the relationship.
Yeah.
And after what I felt like is a fair amount of time, I contacted the client. And she laughed and said, "I'm surprised it took you this long to call me." And by the time that their contract with my former employer was up, I took that piece of business and wrote that newsletter on and off, more on than off, between 1989 and I just lost it last year.
Oh, wow.
The subscription. So these newsletters are subscription-based, which basically means that the publishing company needs enough accounting firms to buy them, you know, and send them out to their customers, and the subscription just ran out. So
that
happens. But again, I mean, we're talking about what, 30 years of a newsletter title. I mean, that's mind-boggling.
That's crazy.
That's absolutely mind-boggling. So so most of the ones that I work on are produced on a quarterly basis. One produces every other month, and again, it's regular income.
I'm curious about something related to economic timing, because obviously you went freelance at like the bottom of the last recession and have been doing it through this long you know, upslope into kind of some weird uncertain territory that I don't think quite yet qualifies as a recession, but it's kind of like, where's things gonna go, you know? And I'm curious, because in my experience, in my niche, I've actually seen less and like the overall work for freelancers does not diminish in an up economy. If anything, it goes up, but the type of work, I feel like a lot of companies hire less freelancers in an up economy because they make full-time hires for some of these writing needs. Whereas when the economy is down, when it's uncertain, they're offloading full-time employees, but still a lot of that work still has to get done. And so they look for the lowest cost denominator to get the work done, which even if you're a high charging freelancer, you're still less expensive than a full-time hire. And so I'm just curious what you've seen in your niche or, you know, just in general with your work. Do you feel like the demand or upside as a freelancer is, you know, higher when things are uncertain or in a down economy, or higher, you know, definitively when it's an up economy, or basically kind of the same, you know, all the way through?
It's kind of the same all the way through. It really is. You know, as you said, I started my freelance business in the depths of the Great Recession, and it had no impact whatsoever on me getting my freelance business off the ground. And up until this year, actually, my income has increased pretty steadily, plateaued some years, dipped just a little bit, gone back up again. But it's stayed pretty steady for my entire freelance career. And so, we'll give Jacob just a second to get back.
Sorry, can I ask a question while Jacob is there?
Of course.
Hi. So I was wondering if, what do you think, like, do you ever, since you write so much, do you ever like get writer's block, and how do you deal with that? And then also how did writing in general change since '90s, since you graduated with, you said journalism, right? Like,
yes.
With the era of the internet, like how did you like notice some, I don't know, some like significant changes or like some trend? Curious.
Sure. Great question. First question, writer's block. You know, I'm fortunate that it almost never happens to me. It really doesn't. And I don't know how that is, because honestly, I pretty much write every day, all day long. That's I mean, of course there's some admin work involved in running any kind of business, but I mean, for the most part, I pretty much write all day long, every day. And I very rarely get writer's block. And when I do, I just kind of push through it. I mean, if I have to get up and, you know, go for a walk around the neighborhood, or, you know, do something to just kind of break out of the routine there or whatever, I will. But fortunately for me, it's not too much of an issue. As far as changes in writing trends and style and everything, I mean, obviously the internet is the main one. You know, in 1985, there was no internet. Everything that was written for print. And, you know, writing for internet is a different style than writing for print. And I'm not going to talk a whole lot about what those differences are. I think most writers are pretty familiar with that, but I mean, that's definitely the main change in writing, as well as search engine optimization. Now, just because you're writing for the internet doesn't mean that you're writing SEO copy. Far from it. Most of my clients don't really ask me for search engine optimized copy. And even the ones that do, I get a sense, really aren't as SEO savvy as they probably should be. The clients out there who are super SEO savvy and really know what they're talking about and what they're looking for when it comes to SEO copy, in my experience, are pretty few and far in between.
Yeah. I always say people who are asking for SEO copy don't really know what SEO or copy is.
You see the same thing, huh? Yeah, I mean, exactly. I have a client who says, you know, we start the process of, you know, they tell me what they're looking for, and we start talking about things. We want SEO copy, you know, and I'm like, okay, well, that's great. I can, you know, you, I don't do SEO keyword research. You give me the keywords, I'll work it into the copy. And I can do that. But again, I don't brand myself or position myself as an SEO copywriting expert. If you give me the keywords, I'll work it into the copy. I know how to do that. And I know how to work it in reasonably well so that it's well written and the words and the keywords are optimized. But in terms of really knowing their SEO stuff, I've worked with a handful of clients over the years who, to be honest, really know what they're doing when it comes to an SEO standpoint.
Yeah. Plus too, with a lot of newsletters, you know, you're not even publishing it to the web. In some cases, you're sending it into people's inboxes and their essays, you know. So. Cool. Does anyone else have any questions? One more question. Go for it.
I mean, I have questions if nobody else has them.
Yeah, go for them.
So I was wondering, so like when you transitioned to freelancing, you had to do, well, I'm sure you had to do a lot of research before that as well, right? So like, what's your approach as far as like, so if you divide like the amount of research, like the effort that goes toward research versus the one that goes toward writing afterward, like if you have some kind of formula or some, I don't know, some like, if you can share your approach with that.
Are you talking about building in terms of building the business or writing content?
No, writing content. When you have the topic and you have the, you know what you need to write on, and then it's time for doing some research and.
I understand. I got the question. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, given that I write in the financial services and business industry or niche, I mean, a lot of research goes into everything that I write. You know, of course, nowadays, research consists of Google pretty much. I mean, any research project that you start with the internet and just, you know, looking for the information that you need that exists somewhere online. And so that's how I usually start. Now, I also do a decent amount of primary research, calling and interviewing experts. Fortunately, I learned how to do that well, again, going all the way back to my very first job. So I'm pretty comfortable when it comes to calling a subject matter expert and doing a formal telephone interview to get the information that I can't find just doing my own research. So that's a big part of, I mean, again, most of what I write is articles. I do some website copywriting. To be honest, I prefer writing articles over writing website copy. I don't know. It's just more fulfilling. It's more fun to me. And so anytime you write a research article, which is essentially what I'm doing now, it's not like a term paper type research, but you know what I'm talking about, a magazine article, a newsletter article, a blog. Most of what I write is blogs. It's got to be well researched. It's got to be accurate. you know, the financial services and accounting industry in particular, where I write a lot, is they're super sticklers for accuracy. It you really can't afford to make technical mistakes. I write a lot about tax legislation, tax reform, all of these things. I've got to get the details right. And so I spend a lot of time and effort making sure that I get the details right. Now most of what I write, especially like I was just describing, very technical tax and financial articles, it does go through technical review. So there are people who are responsible for catching any errors that I make, but I really try hard not to make any, because obviously those make me look bad, and I want to make it as accurate as possible. So research is a really, really big part of what I do. Whether it's, you know, online Google research or primary research interviewing subject matter experts.
And do you kind of have a pool of subject matter experts who know you and are pretty happy to hop on a call with you from time to time? Or do you tend to reach out to make new connections with new subject matter experts pretty regularly? Or is it kind of a combination of both?
I have a pretty good stable. I've got a pretty good stable of experts who I know I can contact about particular topics, pretty much at any given time. Now, like I was saying, those technical tax and accounting newsletters that I write, they have editorial advisory boards, and I'm free to call any of them at any time. I mean, that's what they're there for. So that's super helpful. But I also have just contacts and experts that I've built up over the years that I can reach out to pretty easily.
Nice. I remember when I was doing blog content in the conversion rate optimization space, which is, I would say probably a similar level of technicality, probably not quite to that extent, but relative to most marketing and sales niches, it's a lot more technical, a lot more numbers driven, a lot more detail driven. And having one of the first pieces I did was like a roundup post that incorporated insights from a bunch of different experts in the space who the client I was working with had access to. And then I was able to use that initial group that I got, basically the ones who seemed enthusiastic to give their response, not like, oh, why are you, you know, contacting me? Then it was like, okay, I can reach out to you again for these other pieces. And, you know, even though if it's not a roundup post, I just need a few insights from people who kind of know more and might have an interesting angle to spin. And that can be a super, super helpful resource for, you know, taking pieces of content, you know, an additional level of depth and, you know, and evidence. And so just wanted to throw that in there for you guys as well.
So when I first started, I was writing a lot more magazine feature articles than I do nowadays. Okay. Where I would be responsible, where I would, part of the assignment would be to go out and find subject matter experts and actually quote them in the articles. Mm-hmm. Costco Connection is a good example. Anybody who's a member of Costco probably gets that Costco Connection magazine in the mail every month. You may read it, you may toss it out, I don't know. But anyway, I wrote pretty regularly for them for a number of years. And those were formula articles. I had to interview and quote 3 subject matter experts at least for each article. I had a pretty regular stable of people I knew I could contact. But when I was doing more of that feature article type writing, there was a service, and I haven't used it in so long that I can't even remember what it's called. But you could basically go in, and it was kind of a PR type thing. And as a writer, you could go in and say, I'm looking for experts on such and such for this kind of article. And then, of course, PR firms, subject matter experts would, you know, peruse that, looking for opportunities to get quoted in the media. And that was a great source for finding experts also. But gosh, I'm drawing a blank on what the name of it is. I haven't used it in so long.
Alex can say it.
Yeah, he knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Not Haro. Okay.
Haro, that's it. Thank you.
Oh, it is Haro. Okay. Alex thought you might be talking about Haro. Yeah, I tried to use Haro for link building at one point to see if I could like get some submissions into these publications that would link back to me. It was definitely for the niche that I was going for, it was pretty few and far between, and the ones that were there, I'd never hear back from, so I gave up after a little bit. Probably could have worked out if I had been more consistent, but.
I mean, if you're writing feature articles and need to quote subject matter experts, that's the place to go. Definitely the place to go. It's
Oh, you were using it from the other end. That makes sense. You were using it from that's right, okay.
I was using it from the writer perspective to find subject matter experts I could interview and quote.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd imagine. Did you have to pay for that from the journalist end?
No, I think the subject matter experts paid, but it was free for frequent writers and journalists.
Cool. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Alex mentioned he had a question as well that he was going to mention after Rashid. Did you have a question, Alex? Ah, here we go. All right, I'll read it out loud for the audio. Here it is. I've written a ton of financial pieces, mostly for publications. I have a growing portfolio of other financial material, but the bulk of it is still, stock type analysis content. What would be the best way to leverage that background to get some high value financial industry clients? And what sort of companies or decision makers would you suggest that I target to get, you know, these sort of newsletter or recurring contracts?
Yeah, you were. I would say the marketing departments of financial institutions. You're definitely going to want to go through the marketing department. It's a matter of finding out who the marketing director, assistant marketing director, marketing coordinator, somebody like that who you're looking for at financial institutions. And the term financial institutions is a very broad term. I think primarily of banks. And obviously, there's lots of banks out there. There's the big banks, the Bank of America's, the Chase, and so forth. But there's also smaller community banks. Those are good places to look for. They don't have the huge, massive bureaucracies that the big banks do. Again, they're smaller community banks, and so you might try knocking on the doors. You might try going into the headquarters of some of your local community banks. But that might be an opening. Investment companies as well. The mutual fund companies, the big mutual fund companies, they use freelance writers. In fact, if you said that you have a lot of stock type writing, then I would say that mutual fund companies might be a good opportunity as well. So within that very broad umbrella of financial services, I would say you're basically talking banks, investment companies, and financial advisors. I almost forgot about financial advisors. Investment advisors, registered investment advisors, basically the people who you would hire to help, you know, manage your personal finances and your investments. They're doing a lot of communicating nowadays, writing blogs, publishing newsletters, that kind of thing. And so those are also, I think, good prospects. I've got, I'm working with several different registered investment advisors now in producing their blogs and newsletters. So hopefully that's a few good ideas to help you prime the pump a little bit for your financial services writing. Did Alex have a follow-up question there, Jacob?
What's that?
Did Alex have a follow-up question there? I thought I saw something.
He said he actually has a financial advisor client right now. Ooh. They don't seem to have a ton of money for marketing. Maybe I just need to find the more successful ones. Always a great client acquisition strategy for a writer. Find the more successful ones. That is always good advice.
Financial advisors are a great niche, definitely.
I've noticed too, I followed Ramit Sethi on Instagram recently, and all of a sudden I'm seeing a ton of financial advisors follow Ramit because he's kind of like, his brand is very kind of in that same niche and he's very good at what he does. I've been seeing his posts will just get blown up with all these financial advisors who are branding themselves on Instagram, that's all they do is, you know, financial advice. So that could be, you know, if you're thinking about going after that, those clients, a lot of them have pretty decent followings and they're at least projecting the I'm successful image on Instagram, whether or not it's accurate, you know, but at least it's a decent pool to go. You could go, you know, kind of look through that lens to find some people and reach out to, you know, offer stuff like that. I think Instagram's probably still a semi underutilized channel to try to connect with people for clients because most people aren't doing that because no one really wants to be pitched on Instagram, but that's just kind of how, you know, marketers ruin everything. So you just want to ruin it before everyone else gets to ruining it. You know? So always a thought there. Awesome. Well, I think that about wraps up the hour. Kind of in closing, Don, is there any quick tips you can give us for, you know, primarily writers who are past that initial beginning stage, kind of have a client base, but, you know, are looking to take it up to that six-figure level, take it up to that more consistent level. Any closing thoughts?
I guess I would just, again, emphasize the niche aspect, niche versus generalist. the analogy I've used before is, you know, being the big fish in the little pond or the tiny little fish in the giant ocean. As a generalist, you're a tiny little fish in a giant ocean of freelancers out there trying to drum up some business. If you can find a profitable niche, then you can be that big fish in that little tiny pond. Of course, there's lots of benefits to that. You know, you can establish yourself as you know, one of, if not the experts in your particular niche, and you can charge more money. And so that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Love it. Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Don. This was
been looking forward to it. I hope it was helpful.
I certainly learned a lot, and I have no doubt that everyone here and everyone who will watch this interview afterward will get a lot out of it too.
Hey, Right Bites Club. Thanks for joining us for this interview. We'll catch you next month with another interview from another talented writer. Take care.